you'll notice that there are two empty chairs. Justice Wilcox has had a family issue and is not able to be with us this morning. He will participate in this case and will listen to the oral argument on the tape. I had expected Justice Babbage by now, but he's not here, so we will proceed, and I'm assuming that he will participate, but if he doesn't, you will be advised. This case was held over from September, and we hope, Mr. Cock, that everybody in your family is well. Good. 00-0043, Bruzas versus Cipriano Caseda Garcia. Ms. Breeze, Jake, will argue for American Family. Counsel?
Good morning. I'm Joanne Breeze Jake. I'm with the law firm of Hostek, Hensel, and Bickler, and I'm here today representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Just so that the status of the record is clear, we initially represented Mr. Quesada Garcia as well, but he has been dismissed with prejudice, so there are no claims pending in that regard. The issues certified by this court are twofold. The first is, does an ERISA plan have to include an express grant of discretionary authority in order for a deferential standard of review to apply to the plan administrator's determinations under the plan? And the court has...
Speak up, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And I feel like I'm talking loud. Thank you for asking. And the second issue is a subset of the first. Specifically, what does the arbitrary and capricious review entail in the event that there is discretion granted to the plan administrator? As you can see from the briefs that have been submitted by the parties, this is a matter of great debate across our country, and there are splits and fractures among the courts, and there are many different opinions, largely because there is no binding authority on this issue aside from the Firestone versus Brook case, which doesn't directly address it but does provide some guidance. The respondents have taken the position that there's no need for an express grant of discretionary authority and asks the court to take a looser approach to determining whether the arbitrary and capricious standard of review should apply, and then goes on to argue for a reading of the ERISA plan that allows basically the plan administrator to rewrite the terms of the plan in this particular case in the guise of an arbitrary and capricious review. Excuse me. This position is taken largely because in the event that this court makes a narrower holding, the trial court will be reversed. What we have done in our brief is try to analyze the case according to the four sources of recovery, potential recovery at stake, and look at the issues raised in terms of the potential sources of recovery. The issue is very straightforward with respect to the liability and UIM policies of insurance. The law is clear as far as the Central States case, the Biomet case, and the hotel employees case, that third parties cannot be bound to an arbitrary and capricious standard of review under ERISA. There's no authority for that. The Central States case says there's no authority for this novel proposition that somehow a third party can be subject to an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, or that third parties' abilities to settle with their own insurers are somehow incorporated into the ERISA plan's mandate.
Counsel, I think you may have been the only one to cite the Central States case.
I believe so.
How does that, could you give the facts of the Central State case and how it fits in with the other cases that are cited more frequently in the briefs, the for instance, the Cutting case and maybe the Newport News case? And chronologically, how does that fit in? Central States is a Seventh Circuit case also.
Central States is a Seventh Circuit case, and the date of it I am not certain about can. But I can tell you that it's the case, the facts of the case are that State Farm Insurance Company was settling with its insurers. And the ERISA healthcare plan brought an action saying, you are not entitled to compromise our rights through settlements with these insurers. And the Central States Court held that no, the ERISA plan cannot tell State Farm what it can do in terms of settlement. And essentially what it is confirming is that the ERISA health care plan's rights and remedies are as against its plan beneficiary, because that is the person who is a party to the ERISA health care plan. And so any terms and conditions of the plan would apply to the beneficiary, not to third parties. It fits in with the Cutting versus Jerome Foods case, for example, insofar as Cutting versus Jerome Foods did not take the issue and say you can recover directly from a UIM carrier or from a liability carrier based on your plan language. What Cutting versus Jerome Foods said is it took a liberal approach to the arbitrary and capricious standard and then essentially said that based on a grant of discretion, the make-whole doctrine can be overridden by an ERISA health care plan in the context of a plan that says we are subrogated to the extent of any recovery that you get, which is different than the case here at hand because our language is different. But Cutting versus Jerome Foods did not say anything to the effect that an ERISA health care plan can go to the UIM carrier itself and impose its terms and conditions upon the UIM carrier in terms of settlement and obligations.
Saying Cutting didn't deal with the third-party issue, is that what you're saying? Or?
It dealt with the issue in terms of whether the person who is a beneficiary of the ERISA health care plan can be required to give the money back to the ERISA plan. And that's in our case, is the analogous situation of the liability payment and UIM payment, as opposed to the policies themselves. So the Cutting holding is not directly applicable to the liability policy and the UIM policy. However, the Central States case is, and that is the Seventh Circuit, and that's how you can make these cases fit together. Now, the Cutting case itself, as we've demonstrated in our briefs, I don't agree with the analysis contained in that case as far as its formulation of what arbitrary and capricious review entails. Because what Cutting says is basically we're going to turn a blind eye to what the plan administrator does if there's any reading that can override the make-whole doctrine. Other cases, such as the Barnes case, the Cagle versus Bruner and the Copeland Oaks case go through an analysis that says make-whole is the default. Under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, in order to override the default, the plan has to advise the beneficiary that this is going to occur. They're not saying that the plan cannot do it. What they are saying is that if you want to override make-whole principles, put it in your plan. If you want it, you have to write it. And it is easily written in terms that say we are going to override the default make-whole principle, and in the event that there are not sufficient funds, we will be entitled to the first priority of payment. And those cases establish that requirement as necessary in order to override the default make-whole principle. And in terms of this case, you've asked for a general analysis of what the arbitrary and capricious standard of review entails. And the Booth case looks at it from the standpoint of a denial of benefits and raises several factors that the court should look at even under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. The Cutting case conflicts with Booth insofar as Cutting doesn't really look at anything other than there's discretion, therefore they can do what they want, is essentially the Cutting holding. Now, in Booth, they say, look at the language of the plan. Look at the goals of the plan. Look at materials considered, whether it's consistent with ERISA's requirements, whether the process was reasoned, and also look at the motives of the plan administrator and any potential conflict of interest. That is consistent with the Firestone holding, which Firestone declined to incorporate the arbitrary and capricious standard of review on a wholesale basis, based primarily on the court's concern that ERISA was enacted to provide additional protection to beneficiaries. And the court was concerned with the fact that the arbitrary and capricious standard of review would, in fact, decrease the protection allowed to ERISA beneficiaries. And if that occurred, the court said, yes, you can do it, but you have to have it in your plan. The court didn't take the next step of saying what type of language is necessary in order for the the plan to be accorded administrative discretion, and that's why there is the debate across the country. But it did say conflict of interest would be a factor to be considered under the arbitrary and capricious standard of review if the plan reserves that right to itself.
So what do you think the plan has to say? You probably don't favor any language.
I'm sorry?
I said, what language does the plan have to use?
In order to grant discretion?
In order to grant discretion.
Well, I think that the language in cutting where it says that all decisions concerning the interpretation or application of this plan shall be vested in the sole discretion of the plan administrator is at least arguably a grant of discretion that could meet the criteria necessary. The cases such as POSTMA and other cases cited in our brief, they establish that the necessary thing is to provide the beneficiary with notice of what is going to happen to them in the event that there's a disagreement. I think that cutting could be made clearer by saying that we're going to have our sole discretion and any judicial review will be subject to an arbitrary and capricious standard. I mean, clearly that's at the end of what could be said in order to be clear enough. But the cases establish that it needs to be a clear and unequivocal grant of discretion, and that is because we need to provide people with notice of what's going to happen. In the case before the court, we've looked at the plan and we've raised some issues as far as ambiguities that are contained in the plan. We've cited case law saying that ambiguities in this circumstance should be construed against the drafter, and that is again because ERISA was enacted to provide protection to its beneficiaries. And if you're going to err in favor of one side or the other, you err in favor of construing against the drafter and saying, no, that's not sufficient to grant discretionary authority.
Is it your position, then, that as to subrogation clauses in ERISA plans, there has to be some specific mention in the language of the plan about make whole or some establishment of priorities?
Would
speak to that?
Yeah, in terms of whether the arbitrary and capricious standard will apply, I don't think that the grant of authority necessarily has to say it will apply to subrogation. If the grant of authority is limited in some fashion, like in the Sanders case where it was limited to settlements, like in the Schultz case also, they considered this grant of authority is limited to this area. In our case, the grant of authority, if there is one, appears to be directed to denial of benefits. This is not a denial of benefits case. This is a subrogation case. And in terms of providing the beneficiary with notice that in the event that this plan says it is entitled to take all the money that they went and purchased for themselves basically by buying UIM coverage from dollar one, this plan is insufficient to tell the beneficiary that the court is not going to engage in a de novo review, which is the default.
Isn't the language conferring authority on the administrator a lot broader than that, though?
It goes
beyond decisions about entitlement to benefits and includes the power to construe and interpret the plan provisions and to determine all questions arising under the plan. That's pretty broad.
Sure, and there's case law, as the Sanders court discussed and in Schultz, there's case law establishing that when it's identifying who is going to be responsible for this particular issue, the plan has to be construed somehow by someone internally in order to make benefits decisions. This, in my opinion, tends to be language that's providing the authority to telling you that the plan administrator is going to be the one who interprets the plan. It says power, not discretion, in there. And in addition, when it says that the decisions will be binding upon all persons, it goes on to say that you shall have no appeal from any ruling, etc., which is within the authority, except as provided in Section 8.4. Section 8.4 is limited solely to denial of benefits, and that's why it becomes even more confusing in this case. There, first of all, giving final decision-making authority, Schultz rejects that as a basis for finding a grant of discretion. And I believe it's in footnote 4. And the reason for that is that this appears to be telling people that if you have a question on a claim, the claims administrator is going to decide it, and you have an appeal right on your denial of benefits that is in this form, and then internally, that's the end of things. That's going to be a final decision. And the ultimate, I mean, and I'm going to say that this plan, it tests the fringes of what is a sufficient grant of authority. I don't think that it's not in the middle. It clearly has some language that could, in some circumstances, be considered a grant of discretion. But the plan also says that notwithstanding any other provision in the plan, the committee will exercise the powers granted here under for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to participants and other persons entitled to benefits and payments under the plan. And when the plan incorporates that language, it's reassuring the beneficiaries that we're going to exercise any discretion that we may have in favor of giving you benefits. And that injects an ambiguity into any discretionary language that they could argue exists that can't be overcome. You need to provide people with notice of what's going to happen so they can make reasoned choices as far as their benefits are concerned. Given this language, Mr. Bruzos would not have known that the argument was going to be made that this court is not entitled to fully review the plan administrator's determination of his subrogation rights. He had an appeal right if it was a denial of benefits that it was not followed in this case. There was no right to appeal internally anything because there was no internal decision.
Sort of begs the next question that I was going to ask, which is there any distinction between cases involving denial of benefits and cases involving what really is just a pure legal question about the interpretation of plan language? I mean, when I think of deferential standards of review because of a grant of discretion on the part of some lower tribunal, or in this case a plan administrator, or in the case of agency law, an agency, etc., usually we're talking about decisions that are truly discretionary in nature, whether a particular claim is entitled to payment under the plan language by virtue of the type of claim that it is, etc., resolution of a variety of questions, legal and factual. What we've got here is a pure legal question about interpretation of plan language as to whether somebody is or isn't entitled to, whether the plan, that is or isn't entitled to subrogation based upon federal common law of ERISA on that issue. That's not a discretionary issue. That's a legal issue, right?
Right, and that's the Cagle case says, that either it's there or it's not. Either you have the language that overrides the make-whole principle or you do not. There is no interpretive question for the plan to consider.
Which case is that again?
The Cagle versus Gruner, I believe. No, Cagle. C-A-G-L-E. It has language in there stating that either there is an override of the make-whole or there's not. There is no interpretive question for the administrator to consider. And that is in keeping with Firestone's statement that you have to have a discretionary issue in order for the arbitrary and capricious standard of review to even come into play. I don't know that any other case has necessarily made that statement or approached it in that fashion, but there are several cases, such as the Ohio case, the Barnes case, the Copeland Oaks case, where they say that in order to override, you have to have the language. Anything short of language specifically overriding make whole and specifically saying we're entitled to first priority of payment is arbitrary and capricious. And significantly, it is not difficult for an ERISA plan to include this language in the body of the plan. It's two sentences. That's something that's recognized by the Sanders Court. They could have, especially in this case, they could have reserved the right just by putting two additional sentences in.
I have JAR.
Which are, we are entitled to first payment of any recoverable funds, and we will be overriding the make-whole principle in this plan. I mean, that's not an artfully phrased way of saying it, but it's very simple. Those two concepts can be embodied by two sentences that then reject the make-whole principle. Yes.
As a follow-up to what you just said, now I have two questions. First, has the plan administrator interpreted this plan on this issue?
In this particular case, there's no evidence in the record that the plan administrator interpreted it in any fashion. And that also has been stated as evidence of an arbitrary and capricious review under the standard.
I understand, at least I'm looking at a quote from the Central States case that says, deferential review is appropriate only when the trust instrument allows the trustee to interpret the instrument and when the trustee has in fact interpreted the instrument. That is a condition precedent to deferential, the consideration of deferential review. And I want to know if there's a stipulation that that has occurred. And if not, how can we even get to the issue of deferential review?
Well, I think that that's a factor in determining, I think that that's a factor in determining whether the asserted position is in fact arbitrary and capricious. So the first threshold question is there a sufficient grant of authority? And the second question is, if there is, was an arbitrary and capricious decision made? And what does arbitrary and capricious review entail? The cite that you've given me goes more to the second question, which is, what does arbitrary and capricious review entail? And cases indicate that an absence of any evidence of prior consistent interpretations and an actual interpretation by the plan administrator is evidence of arbitrary and capricious consideration of the issue. So that would, Central States is saying it in terms that indicate that it's fatal to arbitrary and capricious review.
I don't know if this goes to advisory opinion once removed, you know, we're answering a certified question to the Court of Appeals, but it seems to me if an interpretation has not yet been made by the plan administrator, then what decision exists to which we owe deference or can apply deference?
Well, I think that's a factor that this court can definitely place into its opinion.
But maybe the case is not right. I mean, I don't know if that's the point of
that's what I'm talking about, advisory twice removed.
Yeah. But if you don't have, if there isn't a decision by the person scheduled to make these decisions saying, we demand payment, we demand all the payments made to the Broussards, right?
Right.
We demand all the payment, then issue hasn't been joined.
Well, I think that is a concern in this case, although I would guess that the respondent would take the position that it has been asserted that there are rights, and the rights have been asserted on behalf of the plan administrator and the discretionary decisions that it is entitled to make. But I will be candid and say that the standard of review was not one of the primary focuses in the trial court, and that may be why there was no submission of an actual decision. There is no actual decision. There is also no evidence of prior consistent interpretations of the plan. I think that it does not...
This is a self-insured plan.
Well, it is a self-insured plan to which the employees contribute.
Okay. But the party here was the laboratories, not the plan. Isn't that right?
I think that is the named party.
Right. And so, in effect, what you're saying, or somebody is saying, is that the employer is representing here the plan. And the employer is saying what the administrator would say if the administrator were asked.
And I think that is
who's the independent party here?
I don't think there is an independent party, and I think that shows that there's a great conflict of interest, as we've argued in this matter, because the plan has every reason to ask for the money back from Mr. Bruises because it saves the company money if they can get this money back.
Well,
and, go ahead.
No,
that's all right. That was the end.
That led me to my second question, and that deals with an area of concern. What case law should I be looking at for the premise that even though there is no federal legislation on issue, that ERISA can overrule state statutory or common law? You know, if I don't have to deal with any supremacy clause on a particular issue, whether it be Family Medical Leave Act or any other issue, what cases say that ERISA trumps state common law in instances where the feds have not spoken?
Well, there is, and I'm sorry, I don't have the statute right in front of me. I can get it when I'm sitting down. But there is a preemption provision contained in ERISA that says basically state laws cannot trump ERISA. And then it has a savings clause that says, except in the instance of, I believe it's regulation of insurance, then that is saved from the preemption, but then there's an exemption to the savings clause that puts it all right back in. And I think the FMC versus Holiday case discusses the nature of federal preemption and what ERISA provides for in that context. But the fact of the matter is that Cutting versus Jerome Foods even recognizes that ERISA contemplated the creation of a federal body of common law in the event that ERISA is silent on an issue. ERISA is, everyone concedes, silent on the question of what the relative subrogation rights are. The 6th, 9th, and 11th circuits in the Cagle, Barnes, and Copeland Oaks cases have confirmed that make-whole principles, as are discussed in Rhymes, the principles are no different than what we in Wisconsin have always done, are the default principles under an ERISA plan. And so the federal common law supports the fact that default is make-whole, and now what does the plan have to do in order to override that? The respondent would have the court say that in order to override the default make-whole rule, all that there has to be is discretionary authority. That's not a good law. That's not one that this court should follow. That the ERISA policies can override it by just saying we have first priority of payment and make-whole rule is explicitly disavowed. In addition, the ERISA plan could tell its beneficiaries that they have to go out and purchase UIM insurance up to $50,000 to reinsure this plan so that the plan is protected in the event of a calamity. They could tell their insureds that these requirements are going to be made and that in the event that you get in an accident and you have been responsible and have purchased your own insurance for your own benefit, we're going to assert a right to take the first dollars out of it. And we might assert a right to take every dollar out of it. And you may have gone and purchased insurance for your own benefit and you're never going to see a dollar of it because we paid $150,000 in medical expenses. And even though we're in the business of taking risks, that's not a risk we want to take. And if the language is put in the plan in those terms, then the beneficiary can make reasoned choices. The beneficiary may have a spouse who has potential insurance. You can make the choice to have your spouse's insurance. You can make the choice to get a different job. You can make the choice to get extraordinary insurance. But absent notice, no decisions can be made.
Ms. Jake, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Koch.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Tom Koch, and I represent the respondent subrogated party, Underwriters Laboratories, Inc. As I understand it, there are two issues for the court for decision today, and I'd like to briefly reiterate them because they differ just a little bit from what Attorney Breese Jack mentioned at the outset of her argument. The first issue, I think, is clear in both parties' minds. Whether an ERISA health benefit plan must expressly confer discretion to a plan administrator before a reviewing court owes deference to the actions and interpretations taken by the administrator under the plan. And the second issue is whether this court needs to clarify the arbitrary and capricious standard of review applicable to an administrator's acts and interpretations due to any incongruities between Newport News versus THE Insurance Company and Schultz versus NEPCO. Neither of these issues, unfortunately, were raised or briefed at the trial court level. They were certified by the District 2 Court of Appeals following our oral argument there, and I think Ms. Breese-Jack would also agree it became abundantly clear to us at the end of the argument that this is what the Court of Appeals was interested in. Unfortunately, we didn't know prior to that time that that was to be the issue of focus. So I would like to address Underwriter's position first, and then with any time remaining, I will address the arguments asserted by Ms. Breese-Jack today. I will not reiterate any of the underlying facts unless the court feels the need to have those referenced. Before discussing the case law applicable to a plan administrator's actions interpretations, I would like to briefly reference underwriter's plan document language, specifically the language concerning its plan administrator's authority to take action and provide interpretations under the plan.
Mr. Cook, before you get into that, I'm very bothered by what I heard from opposing counsel to the effect that there was no evidence of interpretation of the issues by the plan administrator here. Now, I've looked at the stipulation, and certainly at least paragraph 8 of the stipulation seems to indicate that the position has been taken by the Racine Unified and by underwriters that they have policies which allow them to assert a claim in regard to the $40,000 being paid by or to the Brusius under the policy. Is there indeed an agreement that that is the interpretation by the plan administrator, or is this something that where issues have not been joined, as the Chief Justice suggested?
Let me answer that with a two-part answer, if I may. First of all, from the standpoint of liability proceeds and underwriter's ability or right to subrogate against those proceeds, no. There is no plan administrator opinion at issue here. And
What about the UIM?
On the UIM, what happened there was following the trial court's, or actually prior to the trial court's ruling, as a portion of my brief in support of request for reimbursement and subrogation, I enclosed a letter from the reimbursement agent for Underwriters Laboratory, an individual named Henry Romano, who authored that letter and indicated that a third party, or third party, the term third party, should be defined via Underwriters Plan Administrator as anyone other than the insured or covered person, i.e., Mr. Brusius. And that interpretation went unopposed by American Family, and in fact, American Family deposed Mr. Romano, and that issue was not raised in his deposition either. So that would be the only plan administrator interpretation, I guess, that we have before the court today. But my argument, I guess, would not require a plan administrator interpretation because I feel that the terms of the document, the plan document itself, entitle underwriters to subrogation even against the liability proceeds. This is another unfortunate instance where in the something like 7-hour settlement conference, which I remember as if it were yesterday, the issue of plan administrator interpretations never came up. At the trial court level, other than the reference to the UIM definition of a third party, it never came up. So it's unfortunate that we don't have those administrator interpretations in our file today, other than the one.
Well, is the right party here? Why should it be underwriters and not the plan?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
I said, is the right party here? Why is it the laboratories instead of the plan itself?
Look, underwriters is the sponsor of the plan, and underwriters is the self-funded party that actually pays the benefits. So that's why underwriters is the main party. We have no, separate plan entity in this particular instance. Underwriters is the sole.
Who's the administrator? Plan administrator.
The administrator is, I don't have a name to provide to you, but I can tell you that the administrator is simply the Committee on Claims and the Committee on Benefits as referenced in our brief.
Who are they a fiduciary to?
I believe they would be a fiduciary to both all the plan participants as well as the plan document itself.
To underwriters?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why underwriters?
Because they have a fiduciary obligation to their own entity to operate in a proper fiduciary capacity as well.
Well, a corporation isn't a beneficiary of the plan.
A corporation can be the beneficiary of the plan, but it can also, in this instance, as it is, be the sponsor of the plan. And I think, to some extent, yes, they're wearing more than one hat there. But again, because it is a matter we didn't really have to litigate at the earlier level, I don't have more information for you. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, Mr. Koch.
Could I ask you when this plan was created?
Yes.
Thank you.
not sure of the actual inception date of the plan. I can tell you that the amendments and all the language that we've been dealing with is as of January 1st, 1991. And that's stated on Respondent's Appendix, page 108.
What I'm really trying to get at is whether the plan was amended in any way, any relevant way, after the Firestone case.
Well, I have a very large volume of these cases for certain numbers of clients, and Underwriters Laboratories normally would, I think, advise me of any amendments. The other parties tend to, and they all funnel through the same reimbursement agent, Mr. Romano. So I don't believe that there have been any amendments. Normally I'd be provided.
So you can't provide any documentary evidence that they strengthened the subrogation provision or strengthen the discretionary authority of the administrators after the Firestone case. Is that right?
I certainly can on point one. I would say on point two that I feel the language contained in the plan is quite strong, actually.
Do you happen to know, this is sort of off the subject, but the make-whole doctrine, does that apply in many states, or most states, or all states, irrespective of ERISA?
Well, I guess the best answer I can give you is that I don't believe it's a majority rule. I believe that in instances where a plan or a court has no alternative, they have no language to hang their hat upon or to disprove a given subrogation claim, they may default to it. But cutting, which I think is cited more prominently than any other decision here, I mentioned in the brief, I think, 26 different states, 78 different times it's been cited, disclaims made whole as a default rule, and goes to some trouble to say that they don't feel any compulsion to do that today or in the future. And therefore, I feel that made whole would not be viewed as a default rule anywhere, and that if it is anything, it is the minority rule. However, almost every state jurisdiction, I can tell you from personally researching, has a made whole rule within their state law, and they're very similar to Rimes and Garrity as we have here today. So it becomes a question of whether that ERISA plan is entitled to disclaim that made whole rule from the state courts, and I believe that they are here.
So your answer is most states have this as state law, the make whole doctrine.
Yes.
But whether it's becoming part of the federal common law for ERISA is not clear yet.
I don't think it's clear. I think, if anything, the courts have gone the other way. I feel that they've followed cutting as a majority case, a majority rule.
What I'm trying to get at here is our Rimes decision, I think, goes back to 1982. Your plan has probably been in effect a long time under ERISA. You indicated that the subrogation provisions, best to your knowledge, haven't been changed subsequent to the Firestone decision. Why wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that the people administering your plan would be taking a make-whole, giving it a make-whole interpretation for years and years?
It would not be unreasonable. However, if it had been done, I think I certainly would have known. I would have been provided with that interpretation, and normally what would happen is I'd receive the file and be warned that there is a made-whole limitation on this file, that the particular sponsor of the plan or the trustee or plan administrator adheres to make-whole, and I have had that happen in the past. In this case, it has not happened, and I think that our situation in this case is largely disparate from other situations, i.e. fully insured plans, like the recently decided Cavallari's case, a case which I lost, but which I think was lost for the correct reasons, because it was a fully insured plan where their benefits are paid in a different scenario by joint contributions from both plan participants and the company. Here we even have the Ramsey Medical Center case, a site I don't have handy in front of me right now, but it's a Court of Appeals decision from Wisconsin, which says quite clearly, quite succinctly, in situations where a self-insured fund exists and a plan document exists with a subrogation clause, all state-made whole rules are preempted. They are trumped by the federal law. So I rely not only on federal authority, but also Wisconsin authority for the propositions we've argued in our brief.
Counsel, I am mindful that you take the case as you get it, and you can't, and you take the record as you get it. But the Firestone case, and I'm reading from one of the briefs cited this recent law review called A Decade of Confusion, the Standard of Review for ERISA Benefit Denial Claim, as established by Firestone. I assume you might be familiar with that. And with regard to, one of the things that concerns me is the conflict of interest and the state of this record. And the Firestone case stated in part with regard to this that if a benefit plan gives discretion to an administrator or fiduciary who is operating under a conflict of interest, that conflict must be weighed as a factor in determining whether there is an abuse of discretion, arbitrary and capricious. And then the article goes on to describe that since Firestone, courts have taken two approaches with regard to the conflict of interest. One is a presumptively void, if you've got a conflict, you're out. The other is the sliding scale approach, and that is that the amount of discretion given to a conflicted administrator's decision diminishes in proportion to the gravity of the conflict. Mm-hmm. One of those seemed to me to apply here, because it seems to me, looking on the face of this case, that there's a conflict. I might be wrong, so disabuse me of that if I'm wrong, but it sure looks to me like there's a conflict.
I guess I have 2 points to make. First of all, Firestone. It is a very well-worded decision, and I enjoyed reading it, and I was happy to have it as part of my supplemental research over the years on ERISA cases. However, it is a denial of benefits case, which is significantly different from what we have here today, which is a straight subrogation dispute, or as Justice Sykes pointed out, isn't it an issue of law? Perhaps it is simply an issue of law, and one where we don't need to resort to administrator interpretations and discretion, et cetera. Second, I think that anyone who realizes that a plan administrator, in fact, is often working for the sponsor of the plan or employed at their discretion, even as a fiduciary, will find a conflict of interest. And I guess I don't have a huge problem with that, except that in this case, benefits were allowed. The only thing we're after here is what we view as complete justice, and that is simply to have the party responsible for causing the loss to pay us for the benefits that we have paid out.
But isn't subrogation, or not having subrogation, a benefit?
Not having subrogation a benefit?
Yeah. He gets more money. Or at least he doesn't have to pay back money. In this case, it doesn't happen to matter to him because it was settled. But in most cases, that's the kicker issue.
In many instances, yes, the excess money would go to the plaintiff. However, a couple of things are important to bear in mind with respect to this case. First of all, we have American Families Agreement to indemnify Mr. Bruises.
I understand, but the rule of law is going to cover when there's no such agreement. Too.
Yes, exactly. And at least from my viewpoint, it makes a substantial difference when those kind of circumstances exist. And again, we're not after anything more than we paid here. We're simply after what we paid and trying to recover it from a party that we feel has responsibility.
So you agree with Professor Langbein, who said that the U.S. Supreme Court flunked trusts in the Firestone case.
I'm sorry, that the U.S. Supreme Court what trust?
Flunked a course in trusts, because within ERISA itself, it recognizes that the trustee can have a conflict of interest because it's got to be an officer of the company.
Yes, there's a problem there. I admit it. It's an automatic problem. Justice Bradley pointed it out. As soon as everyone sees a plan administrator has made an interpretation that's beneficial to a plan, they say, oh, that's a conflict. And yes, to some extent it is. But I would also submit that it benefits the plan to allow it to be reimbursed, because while Mr. Bruises or one individual may make $10,000 or $12,000 or $15,000 or $50,000 less on their net recovery, the entire plan as a whole benefits, because they get their money back and recoup those benefits and therefore can save money on administrative expenses, etc.
I can just, I was going to talk about the language in the plan document, but it seems like we've already kind of gotten past that. And the one thing I would like to just reiterate about the discretion afforded the claims administrator is that not only is it broad and I think powerful language, I think it's actually better language than we have in Cutting. I think it's better language than I've seen in any case thus far. I don't know that we could comport any better with what is required of us in terms of having the necessary discretion to construe the terms of a plan than to utilize the language we have in sections 8.1 and 8.2 A, C, and D of the plan document. I would also like to talk just briefly, if I can, about the comparison between the Newport News decision and Schultz versus NEPCO. I'm obviously a proponent of the Newport News decision. My brief goes to some pains to explain that I think it's much better reasoned than Schultz versus NEPCO, and I think it makes more sense, and I also think it comports more directly with the language that we have in our plan document. And can you reconcile the two opinions? I've said that yes, in fact, you can, because Schultz is a little bit of a different set of circumstances, and Newport News so closely tracks what we have going on here. In Newport News, the trial court determined that Newport News was entitled to reimbursement of its subrogation lien because it possessed a self-insured plan governed by ERISA and was therefore not subject to Wisconsin's made-whole rule. When THE moved for, the insurance company moved for reconsideration of the decision, arguing from the Sanders versus Scheidler case, we came up with this notion of the support for a federal common law made-whole rule. And the court denied the request to go in that direction on that case, and the court has denied it in the Seventh Circuit in Cutting as well, and I think appropriately so. I do have a big problem with the Sanders v. Scheidler case, and I have even more trouble with utilizing the Schultz v. NEPCO case in some dispositive way against underwriters here. I guess the primary point I want to make about Sanders v. Scheidler in 1993. It states clearly that the de novo standard is only appropriate where a plan administrator has limited or inadequate discretion to interpret the terms of a plan. I have a real problem with applying Sanders to our circumstances because I think our discretion is there and I think it's adequate. So once you exclude Sanders from the analysis, it's very easy to exclude Schultz from the analysis because Schultz is based predominantly on that opinion, and that's where it came from. Newport News, on the other hand, has language similar to ours, interpreted the language in a fashion that also follows Cutting versus Jerome Foods, which I think is an excellent dissertation on what the status of the law was, and I think Ralph Adam Fine went to a lot of trouble to try and set the standard clear for us and to tell us that we don't need a default made whole rule in Wisconsin, not if you're a self-insured ERISA plan anyway. So that would be the extent of what I wanted to mention about those two cases. And there is, I guess, a notion of, well, why is it okay to accept Newport News and why is it not okay to accept Schultz? Well, I've said that both cases can be reconciled, and I do believe that they can. I also feel, though, however, in our instance here, Newport News is an opinion which simply, I don't know if it's fair to say it reads more clearly, but it gives more reference to the plan language. It goes into some detail to discuss the plan
language. What exact language are you relying on? Got the sub, what exact language in the plan? You referred to 8.1, 8.2 subsections.
Oh,
just
sure.
Beat them to us, if you would.
8.1, entitled Claims Administration, and I'll go just to the highlights here. This section provides that all determinations of the plan administrator, quote, regarding the rights and benefits of participants shall be final. In other words, there's some finality to the decisions that this particular administrator can provide. Section 8.2, committee duties and powers. The plan administrator has such powers as may be necessary to discharge its duties hereunder, including but not by way of limitation, the powers, rights, and duties And this is from Section 8.2A, entitled Interpretation of the Plan. The power to construe and interpret the plan's provisions and to determine all questions arising under the plan. That, to me, is the most clear-cut language you could possibly have in terms of, does this administrator have authority to construe this plan? There is additional language, however, 8.2 section small c, benefit determinations. The plan administrator has the, quote, power to hear and decide appeals from determinations of the claim administrator as to the rights of participants and participating dependents. And 8.2 small d, enforcement of the plan. The plan administrator also has the, quote, power to enforce the plan in accordance with its terms and to enforce its procedures, rules, or regulations. And just one more I'll reference. Finally, Section 8.3 of the underwriter's plan provides that every decision of the plan administrator, quote, shall be conclusive and binding upon all for persons affected by it. I have made the argument, and I'll continue to make it, that this actually confers express discretion. I have never seen a plan document or ERISA case that required language saying that you have express discretion to resolve subrogation disputes. It's never happened before, and I think that we run into uncharted waters, and we have a real problem if we create that type of law here, because it's not only because it's never been done before, but because I think it would violate the mandates of all the federal courts that have finalized their opinions and offered us what they feel is a cogent summary of the ERISA law that's out there.
Have you ever seen a plan that doesn't say construe and interpret and determine all questions, power to hear and determine, I'm not so sure about appeals, how to enforce the plan in accordance with the plan, and every decision shall be conclusive and binding?
Have I seen one that doesn't have that language? Yes. Schultz v. NEPCO is a perfect example of a plan that did not have that language. Basically, the language in Schultz v. NEPCO was we have the power, the discretion to make decisions about final settlements. That's radically different from this discretion.
You think that's a quirky plan, or in most plans you have this kind of language? I've drafted many plans, and all my plans had similar language, the standard format of the book.
Well, I have to be honest, Chief Justice, I wish all my plans said that. They do not.
They do not.
I probably have at least three plan documents that have language that I would deem inadequate under both Cutting and
Schultz. Out of how many?
Out of 50.
So it's a minority.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Most plans have this language, or something that's comparable.
Yes.
Because it is form book language.
I think so, and I think that plan drafters, although I don't work with them directly, I think that they're aware of that, and they're very hesitant to change something that works, of course, in a plan document. But I would also submit in opposition to what Attorney Breese Jack said earlier about the two-sentence argument, that you could have all you want in this case, underwriters, if you just added two sentences to your brief. I would submit that it is not that easy. I have one plan document in particular that always is accorded discretion by the attorneys and given the respect it deserves and given reimbursement, and that plan document spends about 4 pages disclaiming the made whole rule, but it does it in every way, shape, and form imaginable. And I've said many times I wish they all were like that, but it is not that easy to draft them. As I noted, I think it's hard to revise them too.
Counsel, I have difficulty with the premise that I suppose I should just accept, but I have difficulty with the premise that an administrator's interpretation of rights and benefits shall be final, and that the administrator, as long as it has specific but general language, has total authority to police itself. And, as I understand the argument, essentially total authority with regard to determining the rights and benefits of the participant to overlook or violate Wisconsin law. That bothers me. I mean, it's like this little fiefdom that exists in an ERISA plan with 200 employees in Nakusa, Wisconsin, ABC Paper Company, and they can throw out our common law if it has to do with rights and benefits of a participant. They can take, for instance, our open records law, Wozniacki. Let's say your plan says anytime we pay benefits, we're going to be entitled to the medical records and the psychiatric records. And anytime anyone wants our psychiatric records, participant, we don't want to go through all this procedures in Wozniacki. We don't want to be involved in court. You know, we're a 200 operation in Nakusa. So you don't have those rights under Wozniacki. We can release all records upon request by any third party. Under your interpretation, that's allowable. I just use that as an example. Any common law can be trumped by specific but general language, and allowing a plan administrator to totally, absent arbitrary and capricious, but essentially police him and herself in an admitted environment of conflict of interest. That bothers me.
Well, my response to that would be very much reference to what you just said at the end of your question, and that is arbitrary and capricious, not only arbitrary and capricious, but reasonable, as Judge Ralph Adam Fine put it. An administrator can't do anything that they want. There is an appellate procedure. There is a claims procedure for them that allows them to appeal up above if they need to, if they feel that they have been improperly denied benefits or something of that nature. Here, we don't have a benefits question before us because benefits were provided. We're past that point. But understanding that the scope of the question is broader than that, I would say that the required behavior of a plan administrator to act reasonably is perhaps even a better term than arbitrary and capricious. And that has to keep them in check, because if they don't act reasonably, they are going to pay a penalty.
The other law that we're familiar with in terms of deference is agency determinations. And take the prior case that we had not too long ago on ERISA, that is the Aurora case dealing with the Family Medical Leave Act. The plan administrator in that case said no benefit. Then they went to the Equal Rights Division. And the Equal Rights Division, an agency, said, here in Wisconsin, said benefit. Now, normally we would say, ooh, does the Equal Rights Division have experience and then give, and if they do, I don't know if they didn't in that case, but let's say they did in a certain issue, then we give them great weight deference, or if it's reasonable, we give them due weight deference. But all of that is out the window, I guess, because all we have to do is forget about them because we have to give you deference. I don't know how all that works.
Well,
it just seems to slash and it just seems to throw out so much of the law that I'm familiar with.
In the example that you just provided to me, I would argue that under Firestone v. Brook, you cannot have an arbitrary and capricious standard of review applicable there. You would need a de novo standard of review.
You would need a what?
A de novo standard of review, because it is a question of benefit versus no benefit. I think that's more clear cut. And I think that's appropriate, because when you deny benefits to a plan participant, you're really making a statement that, hey, you're not getting coverage for what you thought you had coverage for. Whether you paid for it or not, we're sorry, we're taking it away. And arbitrary and capricious may not be an adequate standard to look at that. I guess in Firestone they're saying it isn't, and I tend to agree with that. But from the standpoint of whether subrogation and reimbursement should be allowed, as Justice Sykes pointed out, it may become a straight issue of law. But regardless, I feel that arbitrary and capricious and the standard of whether their actions were reasonable is adequate. And I feel that our amicus curiae brief gives a very good explanation of why that's also adequate. I'm not going to take up much more time since I see that I'm almost out, but I would like to simply provide a brief wrap-up. There are many issues addressed in our underlying Court of Appeals brief, and there's an awful lot of cases and arguments made in this brief. And Underwriters has asked and will continue to ask that the Court adhere to the majority rule, as stated in Cutting, which requires only that a plan administrator be given a reasonable grant of discretion to interpret and construe his or her plan. Underwriters would also submit that Newport News should control over Schultz v. NEPCO on the standard of review issue applicable to plan administrator actions and interpretations, and to the extent that one of the cases needs to go, be limited, or overruled, I would submit that Schultz v. NEPCO should be the one because its analysis is inadequate.
Before you sit down, would you address the Hertzberger case and whether you think it has any application here?
I have just a moment to grab it.
That was the recent 2000 case out of the Seventh Circuit. It's a benefits denial case that sort of drives off of Firestone, but is it your position that the Firestone presumption simply does not apply here, the presumption of de novo review does not apply here because this is not a benefits denial issue?
Yes, yes. With the last caveat, yes, that's okay. My argument, definitely, that it should be a different scenario and it should be viewed differently. And, you know, even in Firestone, we have language that says if a plan administrator is given adequate discretion, you should be using the arbitrary and capricious standard of review. I don't think that Hertzberger does anything to that. I don't think that it harms it. I thought the analysis was in length and detailed and good, and that the opinion from Justice Posner about hastening to reaffirm that courts have consistently held that there are no magic words to determine the scope of judicial review of decisions to deny benefits is a very good point to be made. It's hard to come up with those magic words to make everyone happy. I'm quite convinced that even if we had additional language in our plan, we might still be here today. It's just one of those situations. And Hertzberger, I think, stands for the proposition that an ERISA plan need only provide what the amicus curiae Attorney Bowers refers to as reasonable notice to a plan participant that the plan's administrator or trustees have retained discretion to determine how the plan will be interpreted and applied. And that's, I think, what we're asking for here today, too. So I think we're in alignment with what Hertzberger says and how its ruling comes down. Thank you.
The arguments made with respect to standard of review and the grant of discretion alleged in this case lead to the conclusion that in this particular case, the plan administrator has discretionary decision-making authority with absolutely no rights of appeal within the company and subject to only arbitrary and capricious blind-eye review of this court because denial of benefits decisions are final. I don't think that the language in this plan is sufficient to provide Mr. Bruises or any of the other beneficiaries with notice that this is the case that will be asserted. Boilerplate language should not lead to deferential standard of review. Kearney says that the burden is on the administrator to establish deferential review. The Barnes case says construe against the drafter when determining whether there's an adequate grant of discretion. Brown v. Seiss and United McGill v. Stinnett set forth that there needs to be an express grant of authority. Heine Printing and Kearney say that it needs to be unambiguous. Adams v. Blue Cross uses a language clear and unequivocal. Sanders looks to the fact that if you limit your discretion to certain areas versus other areas, you are not going to have discretion in the areas outside the grant of discretion. Schultz rejects final decision-making authority as a grant of discretion because that's just telling people who is going to make the decision. It's not telling people that if you don't like the decision, you are going to have your usual due process rights circumscribed by this plan so that when you go to court, the court's not going to take a reasoned look at this case. It's going to just close its eyes and take arbitrary and capricious review. Which leads to the second issue, and that is what should arbitrary and capricious review entail? This court in the Evans case before Firestone was ever decided looked at what arbitrary and capricious review should encompass, and it made a reasoned decision that said, we're still going to look at it. We're not going to turn a blind eye. We're going to consider all kinds of factors. Firestone affirms that the approach to be taken needs to consider conflict of interest, and it needs to be a reasoned approach no matter what. As far as the make whole principle is concerned, While cutting can be argued as saying, no, there is no make-whole default principle, the fact of the matter is that Barnes in the Ninth Circuit, Cagle in the 11th Circuit, and Copeland Oaks in the 6th Circuit all say make-whole is the default. And so, Justice Bradley, with respect to your concern that Wisconsin law is somehow being overridden by ERISA here, It doesn't have to be overridden by ERISA. There's plenty of authority, and this court has the authority to say that, as we have always done, our court is going to recognize federal common law that indicates make-whole is the default under an ERISA plan. Now, the next step is what needs to be done in order to override that.
If you, before you move on to that, how many courts have held that make-whole is not the federal default rule, in addition to Cutting?
I'm not certain of any court other than Cutting that has come out and said that it is not the default rule. And even Cutting has language that would indicate that absent discretion, and I'm not sure how their reasoning works, I've looked at it 1,000 times, but absent discretion, maybe the make-whole is the default rule, but we don't need to reach that. There are cases that actually cite Cutting as having established make-whole as the default. So Cutting is somewhat ambiguous in that respect. But all three of these cases do come out and say it is the default. And in fact, Cadle and Copeland Oaks both explicitly reject Cutting as a reasoned way of approaching the circumstance. They say we're not going to follow it. We don't think that kind of a grant of discretion is warranted under ERISA, and we're not going to do it. Instead, if you want make-whole as the default, if you want to override it, include the necessary language. And your concern about conflict is well-placed, because in this case, dollars from one can go for the benefit of all. The plan administrator is always acting with that conflict. The company contributes funds to this particular plan and controls the appointment to the Committee on Claims. That's another inherent conflict in any decision that this particular Committee on Claims would make. It's important because, as you said, there is no real underlying factual dispute in this case. It's a pure what does the contract say type question. And so all of the Booth factors that you would look at, what kind of reasoned approach was taken, are more difficult to apply because we're just looking at language and saying, what does it say? In the context of subrogation rights, then, I think that it is a reasoned approach to go with how Cagle conformed the issue and said, look, there is no interpretive question for the fund to consider and receive deference on in the context of make-whole principles. Either the plan says it or it doesn't. And in Heine Printing, there's a nice quote that says, neither provision adequately informed Brantner that her efforts to receive partial recovery for her serious injuries and consequent financial loss must take a backseat to Heine Printing's subrogation and reimbursement. Though Heine Printing need only have added a single sentence to each provision stating that the make-whole rule is inapplicable, it chose not to do so. If a plan chooses not to include the particular language, then it has to live by that decision. And that is what I submit the law should be in state.
Thank you, Ms. Jake. That concludes our hearing in 00-0043 Bruce S. versus Cipriano Caseda Garcia. I want to thank you.